Whether you're an elite athlete trying to shatter your personal best, a mountain climber looking to prepare for the biggest ascent of your life, or an individual who simply wants to take advantage of the wellness and health benefits of high altitude, we've got the system for you. That's from an ad by Hypoxico, one of several companies selling altitude sleeping systems for athletes, mountaineers, and others. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Should high-altitude tents and other devices be allowed for athletes training for competition in the Olympics? How is hypoxia, or the lack of oxygen, also a problem for non-human athletes such as racehorses? Joining us to explore the hidden dangers of oxygen lack, from mountaineers to Olympic athletes, is Jerome Dempsey, professor of population health science and physiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, oxygen is the thing that obviously we can do without for the least period of time. I mean, you know, food, water, general comfort. But oxygen, you turn that off, and after a minute, people start to get pretty antsy. Mm-hmm. You want to give us a little bit of idea of the physiology of oxygen before we get into these more special instances?
Sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Oxygen is absolutely crucial, as long as we don't have too much of it or too little of it. And in the air we breathe, there's about 21% oxygen. And at the barometric pressure that we exist at in Madison, which is within a couple of hundred meters of sea level, this is more than adequate for performance, for reproduction, for living. It's very comfortable. I think people are most familiar with oxygen lack when it has to do with going to high altitudes. And here the problem, how oxygen lack is created at high altitude, has to do with the barometric pressure. It's the same percentage of oxygen everywhere. If we even go from here to Mount Everest, it's the same percentage, right around 20.9 or 21%. But it's the barometric pressure that falls linearly with the increase in altitude. Interestingly enough, the way our blood carries oxygen is really a beautiful mechanism that lets us go to Denver. And we can do very well in Denver. That's about a mile high. Even 7,500 feet, even up to 8,000 or 9,000 feet. If we just go there and don't go there for too long or exercise too hard, we do very well. You don't even notice that you're there. Planes are pressurized to about 6,000 feet for travel, domestic travel, and about 8,000 feet to go overseas. But hemoglobin, the oxygen-carrying mechanism in our red cells, binds oxygen so tightly until you drop the pressure of it to a pretty low level. So it lets us go to fairly high altitudes without really having a significant oxygen lack. So that's a good thing.
So the pressure is necessary for that bonding of the hemoglobin with the oxygen
to carry it
through our circulatory system.
That's right. And it binds with – that's the key, how much oxygen is bound to hemoglobin.
And if you're living at Denver full-time, I mean, if you're just there, is there any difference if you examine somebody's body from Denver as opposed to someone at sea level?
Yes, you'll find the tiniest bit more but significant amounts of hemoglobin. The body will have adapted and builds more hemoglobin. It's not very much.
And does it matter?
To the people in Denver?
I mean, is it medically important or does it do anything?
Medically, it's not important. I think that's a safe statement, so long as you're healthy to start with. People with bad lung disease can't even fly in airplanes without having supplemental oxygen. It's a huge problem for people trying to travel with lung disease. And so that's a problem if you're in Denver and you have severe asthma or severe lung disease, emphysema, bronchitis, things like that. But for the most part, you do very well.
Are there any natural occurrences or situations where too much oxygen is ever a problem?
Yes. In fact, there's a whole branch of medicine now that's, I think, rather controversial about giving oxygen under pressure. So you put it in not a low-pressure situation but a high-pressure situation. And in Milwaukee, I know, at a couple of the hospitals there, there are chambers where people are treated, especially with infections and wounds, and pretty controversial.
These are the hyperbaric chambers?
Yeah, hyperbaric chambers.
Sometimes even, I guess, for surgery, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And the reason I think they first established them in Milwaukee some time ago were instances of carbon monoxide poisoning in sewer workers there. And they had to get rid of that oxygen. Carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin about 300 times more effectively than oxygen does. So when you get a load of carbon monoxide, that's why it kills you. You get a load of carbon monoxide on, you want to get rid of it in a hurry. And if you've got a high oxygen, that's really terrific. Then the oxygen has a chance to compete. So, yeah, too much oxygen. And we, it's well known the perils of oxygen toxicity. This is especially in the newborn lung, because high levels of oxygen were used for many, many years in premature infants that were born where their lungs were premature. And that proved to be a major problem. I mean, it was essential to use it, but it proved to be a major problem.
Also,
now there are better ways to treat it.
What happens if you get too much oxygen?
Well, the lung can actually become very porous and become very leaky, and fluid can leak in. So it becomes more than a gas exchanger, and you can't have fluid in your lung. It's pneumonia.
Yes.
It doesn't work well.
How do the bends that we're familiar with deep sea divers relate to this?
Of course, that's as you come out of a high pressure
yes.
situation. You come too quickly, and nitrogen is in your tissues. And when you come up too quickly out of a high pressure, then the oxygen bubbles form. And this is the pain of the bends that can be terrible. And
bubbles in your blood.
Yeah. And it gets into the muscle, into the tissue, into the joints, and sometimes into your brain. And so it can be fatal.
Well, let's talk about mountain climbers.
Right.
Because, you know, we know the ones that are going up to Mount Everest and so
mm-hmm.
on. What is it that happens on your way to the top of Mount Everest?
Yeah.
And, you know, are there long-term effects?
Yeah. I have a good friend who's a scientist as well, who climbed Everest. And I've talked to him lots of times about that climb. He did that over 40 years ago. And it's truly remarkable feats that they can accomplish. Although even with him, I remind him that the final 10,000 feet, he didn't go one step without having a bottle of oxygen on his back. So in most cases, although there are several, I think a couple of dozen examples of people that have climbed Everest without supplemental oxygen, they're truly heroic feats, and they're great physical feats that humans have accomplished this. And we also look at things like if we stay at high altitude for a long period of time, we can what we call adapt. We produce more red cells. Our ventilation goes up, our heart rate goes up, anything to bring oxygen transport to the tissue, trying to bring it back to normal. Okay. And these are good. These are good adaptations. But in almost every instance, to every one of those adaptations, there's a cost. And we forget about the cost. For example, we can overproduce red cells. And you can see people living in high altitudes, even a town like Leadville, Colorado, which is about 10,000 feet. And that's the big trouble line, right around 9 to 10,000 feet. That's where hemoglobin can no longer be enough. Then you have to start adapting. And these adaptations take energy. So what you'll see there is increased production of red cells. But people who live, for example, in Leadville, a lot of them are going into the clinic once every couple of weeks to get red cells withdrawn.
What is the problem with having too many red cells?
Blood's too thick.
Well,
very
yes.
hard to push through the capillaries.
Oh, literally, just plain too
yeah.
viscous.
Way too viscous.
So does that mean you get clots or what happens then?
You can get clots or the big problem comes with another adaptation that occurs. Okay. If you're not getting enough oxygen, say, to a tissue, let's take a muscle. The amount of oxygen you get there will be dependent upon the concentration of oxygen in your blood and the blood flow, the amount of blood flow. So if you're not getting enough oxygen, one adaptation that occurs within seconds is that your blood vessels dilate. They get bigger. So you have more blood flow. Okay. So that's a good adaptation. That occurs in every tissue in the body, including the brain, except the lung.
That seems odd.
Doesn't seem odd.
That's a drawback, sure.
Okay. The lung goes the other way. It constricts when it doesn't have enough oxygen. There's a good reason for that. If just a little part of your lung is oxygen deficient, let's say you have lung disease and you're not ventilating a part of your lung, your airways won't open. This is typical lung disease. Then the oxygen's low there. Well, you do not want blood flow to that part of your lung, right? Makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no air,
right,
there's
yes.
no oxygen to pick up. So the vessels constrict, get smaller, and shunt the blood flow to a better aerated part of the lung. Makes pure sense. Now, the problem with going to high altitude is your whole lung's hypoxic.
So it looks like a sick lung, and
you everything constricts.
Everything does.
These vessels are smart, but they're not that smart. Be great if you could turn it off then, but it doesn't. So if your vessels constrict, think about this. Now the right side of the heart has to pump blood through the lung against that load. That's hard on the right side of the heart, very hard on it. And if the blood's thick to boot, trying to push that through constricted vessels becomes a huge problem with the right side of the heart, and you have right heart failure eventually.
Higher incidence of heart attacks in Leadville?
Well, it's not heart attacks. It's heart failure. Yeah. So the S. But people get smart after a while. They can leave, you know.
Right.
And so the problem is, like, we have hypertension. We all know about systemic hypertension. But pulmonary hypertension, specific to the lung, is highly prevalent in people that live at high altitude.
Let's go back over to Mount Everest and those mm-hmm. Sherpa guides. I assume they are some of the ones, maybe even the majority, who get up to the top without supplemental oxygen.
They're too smart for that. Yeah. They're not some of the ones. It's the lowlanders who do it.
There may have been something.
One or two Sherpas, but I haven't heard of them that would put themselves in that kind of danger.
Just the lowlanders, you just think it's this ego thing of getting to the top 5 miles without oxygen.
They'd have to speak to that. But I mean, look at me. I play ice hockey, for goodness sake. I mean, some people think I'm ridiculous at my age going out there to play. But, I mean, I enjoy it. It's fun. It's whatever. And maybe that's something they want to tackle. And I don't blame them for that part of it. But as far as the biology of it, the amount of oxygen in your blood drops so low when you're up there that you don't stay there very long. It's very, very hard to survive.
What are the symptoms of that once you get up there? Is there a risk of losing judgment if you're up there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You don't have to go nearly that high.
And wouldn't you faint pretty quickly?
Well, the blood flow to your brain's fairly high because your blood vessels are opening up.
Okay, so I just want you to imagine me climbing Mount Everest without any help from oxygen here.
Yeah.
What would I start to feel?
The brain would be a major thing, long before Everest, too, as I said. And you would start to become very euphoric. You'd, on occasion, get tunnel vision. I made myself that hypoxic, so I know what – and I have fainted from it twice. So I know mm-hmm. I know what it feels like. And the Sherpas are too smart, but I wasn't too smart.
So you were happy and then you fainted?
Silly scientists doing experiments on themselves. But I did, yeah.
So and you got euphoric, then you fainted.
Euphoria. And you'll hear stories of people stepping into crevasses when it's obvious that's a hole in the ground. But you don't. You lose judgment. And you make decisions like – and you can read about this in all the popular books – decisions about whether to go on or not. There might be snowstorms out there, and you know that weather's not going to break for another day or two. But you go on anyway because you want to climb that mountain, and you're not thinking right.
And the oxygen simply isn't reaching your brain?
No, the oxygen, there isn't enough there, and the metabolism of the brain changes. There are these things called neurotransmitters, and we know a lot about these days, that are their production and turnover in the brain is very oxygen sensitive. So that's a huge thing. Okay, so we've got constricted lungs, hearts working extremely hard. And I'm not talking about Everest. I'm talking about moderate levels mm-hmm. of hypoxia that this occurs at. We ventilate, and that's really important because we want to bring more oxygen in. But the work of breathing, you start a lot of blood flow and now has to go to your chest wall. It can't go to other places. To me, the most startling thing was that this is the human that adapts so poorly to hypoxia. If, for example, you take a laboratory rat and put them in a low oxygen environment, what they do is drop their metabolic rate. We don't do that.
Is that equivalent to like hibernation almost?
Yes.
Okay.
Excellent analogy. When they drop that metabolic rate, they drop the demand on every organ system that has to do with oxygen delivery in the body, the heart, the lungs, everything. And that's such a terrific way to adapt to oxygen lack. We don't do that. The newborn human does in the first little bit of life, but we don't. Us adult humans don't, and a lot of adult animals don't.
Is that still getting back underwater again related to what they call the mammalian diving reflex?
Absolutely. That's what the diving seal, for example, does that beautifully. They'll drop that metabolic rate as soon as their nose hits the water. And their heart rate drops from 100 beats a minute to 5.
Hmm.
So there's much less demand. It doesn't mean they can stay down there forever, right? I mean, they have lungs and they're mammals and they have to breathe eventually. But that lower oxygen demand is so crucial. But we don't do that. We fight it. So some people call that adaptation. I call it maladaptation. It eventually gets to you. And
I call it extirpation.
And I think we were talking earlier, I think one of the there are lots of examples why I don't think we handle oxygen lack well. I've just given you a couple of them. But another one is the whole idea of reproduction at high altitude. Even in towns like Leadville, Colorado, the average birth weight is much lower, even in a full-term baby. There are a lot more preterms. The blood flow to the placenta is sacrificed in a hypoxic environment. It's not very high. There isn't the development of the uterine vessels to carry that blood. So that, to me, convinced me that if the reproductive cycle is being hurt by hypoxia, that's pretty serious.
Do we actually see adaptations like this eventually in the germ line so that these adaptations would actually be, to some extent, inherited from one generation to the next?
Oh, yeah. For example, there are the people who live at high altitude, there are some truly remarkable adaptations. For example, the capacity of the lungs of people that are born and raised at high altitude is much larger than ours. The diffusion capability of the lungs, almost double ours. They don't have to be athletes, none of that, just being born and raised there. And some people think that the Himalayan people are different. In some ways, they don't seem to have that real high red cell mass that people at other high altitudes in other parts of the world, like the Peruvians, have. But that's still being studied these days. And finally, now the geneticists are getting involved with that. Maybe we'll find something special there. But even they have trouble at high altitude. Like in Tibet, it's very common now for especially the Han Chinese that moved to Tibet. They were having babies up there. They're having problems. So now when they get pregnant, the women move to the valleys. And they have those babies at low altitude, and I think they keep them there for some time afterwards too. Now they want to go back to their lands and live there and everything, and they do that. So that's a lesson there too. I think there are all kinds of these pointers. Now, a lot of people don't agree with me on this. They say, no, humans adapt beautifully to high altitude. Well, I disagree.
Well, we have the Olympics coming up next week, and we're going to talk about high altitude oxygen lack and the Olympics when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Altitude training is absolutely essential. Any athlete who wants to be competitive in the world scene would have to move to altitude or cheat by using an altitude room or taking illegal drugs. It's a comment of Alberto Salazar, a former champion marathoner who coaches elite distance runners for Nike. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jerry Dempsey, and we're talking about oxygen lack from mountaineers to Olympic athletes. Well, Olympics and oxygen lack. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the things being done to try to give those athletes a little edge.
Okay. Yeah, this is, I think, a fascinating thing. Winning and going from not making the Olympic team to making it, or going from not medaling to medaling, there's such small differences amongst these elite performers that any insight that the athlete can have to boost just a 1% or half of 1% their performance is a big deal. So way back in 1968, the Olympic Games were held in Mexico City. And they've not been held at a high altitude since then. It became very obvious then that in high-level performers, even a little bit of hypoxia, their performance suffered a great deal. I can remember Jim Ryan, the great American miler who had set the world record near Los Angeles at that same summer, performed very poorly at high altitude. An Australian by the name of Clark, he held 6 world records in long-distance running, didn't come close to winning at high altitude. He just was not hypoxia tolerant. So we became very obvious then that even at And now we know even 1,000 feet above sea level that elite athletic endurance performance is greatly affected. Okay. So the slightest bit of oxygen lacks a problem. Now, the Eastern Bloc nations in the 70s and especially the 80s were training at high altitude and doing quite well. And people thought that was the answer. But it isn't. The problem is that if you train up there, you can't work as hard. The muscle can't work as hard without the appropriate oxygen supply to it. So what happens over time, and actually tissue samples were taken and showed this very beautifully, that if the athlete goes to high altitude and stays there and trains there, he actually detrains. His muscles detrain over time. So that's... while they're getting the added red cells by living there, which helps the oxygen delivery, the muscle can't work as hard. So it's yin and yang. So it's a problem trying to do that. So what people came up with in the last decade was, why not do this? Why not live at high altitude but train at low altitude? So you get the benefits of living at high altitude for a certain period of time a day, get the red cells, and you need such a small change in the number of red cells. You don't want to get too viscous like we talked before. And small change in that, but you train, you let the muscles work and train in a normal environment. So that's a good idea. Well, how do you carry this out?
A lot of commuting.
Logically, you can.
And how much,
yeah,
does
a lot
it,
of commuting.
How much does it take?
Very little. About a 5% change in the red cell volume gets you into the Olympics. Okay? It's that big a deal. And the studies have been done. So this is why doping became so popular. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, likely still is very popular. I'm talking about doping now of red blood cells. In the 80s, probably started in the late 70s, but in the 80s it was carried out by taking a blood sample from yourself, separating the red cells, freezing them, and then a day before you were to compete or so, or 2 days before, reinfuse those red cells. A little complicated.
Oh, in other words, saving them up on the side and then pumping them back in after you have recouped the loss.
That's right.
So it's not really doping in the sense of anything artificial. It's just using your own
body.
You're not increasing your, what is it, reticulocyte, your actually rate
you're
of producing them.
You're increasing the final
just
product.
Increasing the volume.
Right. The reticulocyte is the precursor to the red cell. All right. Yeah. So that's what you're doing. Now, that's illegal. That's
good
illegal.
Idea.
And there's a lot of instances of that. We heard in the Tour de France, the last time it was run, of the European doctors with these laboratories in their basement and these teams coming in and having all these vials of red cells. It was a horror story. And there are a lot of American teams, too. We know of this. There are some deaths that occurred with cyclists in Europe a few years ago where autopsies were never carried out, but great suspicion that this had occurred. Again, the viscosity thing could be a problem.
How could you diagnose, though, if somebody were just injecting their own blood cells back in?
Only if – right. You can't see. There's no foreign substance in there. So it's very hard to detect. All you could see is a higher than normal level of red blood cells. But there's a normal range of plus or minus 4 or 5%. And that upper 5% is enough to get you there. Okay. So you're right. It's very hard to detect. What people are doing now is doing synthetic hormones called erythropoietin that is injected just below the skin subcutaneously. And it will stimulate the bone marrow to produce more red cells. And it's become a major problem trying to detect these sorts of things. And we were talking earlier, Emily, about a study that just came out showing how difficult it is for the laboratories to detect this.
And it looks as if it's controversial. You know, the New York Times study that you're talking about where it quoted the – I guess it was a Journal of Physiology study that you edit that journal.
Right.
And there's an
Journal
article –
of Applied Physiology.
And the article about that particular synthetic – thing and whether it should count for anti-doping and whether the lab results are even accurate.
Yeah. It's a major problem. It's a urine sample. You're trying to distinguish the difference between a recombinant hormone, this erythropoietin, and our normal erythropoietin. And the difference is so tiny. And a major problem in addition to that is, and that came up in this study, was that athletes will take this, then the red blood cells will rise – and stay high, and they'll decrease the amount they're taking of this synthetic erythropoietin, and it'll stay high. But the erythropoietin, even in the blood, have come back to normal by then. So you've got no way of detecting it. Very, very difficult problem. And this study, while still remains controversial, just pointed up this problem of trying to detect this. So it's a major, major problem. And as far as I know, this is still the test that will be used at the Olympic Games. And
so we could be getting some false positive, false negative kind of results.
Well, or negatives. Yeah. That's the problem, not being able to detect it.
What sort of testing is done routinely with the Olympics now? In other words, in particular, how far out do they start testing Olympians?
Well, some athletes are tested all year round. If you've been caught, then you go on a program where you're okay. But a lot aren't. A lot haven't been caught. Oh, the statistic I saw the other day, maybe it was in that New York Times article, I can't remember, of how few positive erythropoietin tests there are in the past couple of years. But yet, when the red blood cells are tested, they are up at that high range of normal. So you know something's going on, but it hasn't been detected. So it's a huge problem.
And you couldn't just test their red blood cell level a year out or 18 months out and then compare that with when you get closer to the Olympics?
You'd have to do it this way. You have to do a roadmap.
Constantly.
Oh, yeah.
Goodness. Well, I saw, we opened the program with a quotation from the Hypoxico company selling these high altitude tents.
Oh,
and so on. And it showed on the website a guy in his office where he had designed the office to be a high altitude thing so that he could be doing his white collar work while, in effect, in training as an athlete or mountain climber.
Yeah. Huge, huge business now.
How do those work?
Same thing as the live – we got off that a little bit. I'm sorry. We got into the doping. And now the alternative to actually infusing your own red cells is dangerous and illegal, or infusing the synthetic erythropoietin is to do it legally. And this is not illegal. That is sleeping in a hypoxic environment and training in a normal oxygen environment. And athletes all over the world are buying these tents. Finland was a big source for some reason of this some years ago.
So it's kind of the opposite of an oxygen tent? It's a low-oxygen tent?
It's a low-oxygen tent. And Nike, I heard this, I think in Portland, that's their headquarters, had a hypoxic house. A house. I can't remember how big it is, but you can imagine. I mean, how expensive
a toxic
this
house,
thing.
Yes, we call that.
For athletes to live in. And then they'd train out of doors. Now, it makes sense. It makes sense for the reasons we talked about before. Mm. Your muscles can work, because the oxygen transport is going to be normal when you're outside. But you live there, you build up these small amounts of hemoglobin. And not everybody has the same sensitivity to hypoxia, unfortunately. It depends on the amount of iron and the ferrit in your red cells and how responsive your bone marrow is. But we all will respond to hypoxia differently in the number of red cells that we can generate. So if you take the same athlete or different athletes and expose them the same amount of hypoxia, they're going to get little different amounts of benefit from it. But it seems to work. There have been several studies done, unfortunately, without really good placebo controls. It'd be hard to do a placebo, but not impossible. They should really do it because there's – and then testing performance in these people. And it certainly improves. And it makes sense that it should. That if you increase the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood, you increase the oxygen transport and you'll perform better.
And there isn't necessarily a psychological component then if it's you're saying if you gave them a placebo and you say, well, your blood has been, souped up, thickened, whatever it needs for this.
Right.
But you're not really doing it because it's a placebo. You think there could possibly be a psychological component to this whole thing?
Anytime you have performance as your major outcome variable, there's a psychological element.
Just
huge psychological.
For confidence that if you think you can do it.
Oh, anybody in doing clinical trials knows this. I remember a study we did years ago of people with terrible lung disease and they retained carbon. They're in respiratory failure and we were giving them a drug. And finally my clinical friend, I'm not a clinician, my clinical friend, Dr. Scatridge, said to me, we better add a placebo to this because we were seeing some effects of this drug. We were shocked at how much we were seeing it. And there was a big placebo effect.
Fascinating.
Even on a chronic level. Oh, and there'll be instance after instance of this. So this is one where they definitely should do it. Now, so this seems okay, right? I mean, it's goofy that we'd go to these lengths and behave this ridiculously, but at least it seems safe. And I think it was so long as the athletes were living with these tents, were having them sleep at, say, 7,500 feet. But what I hear lately is that isn't good enough anymore. They're now sleeping at 14,000 feet. And this is where we get back to what we were talking about in the first part of the program, that is the problems of high altitude. And I didn't even talk about the cardiovascular problems. I talked mainly about the pulmonary ones because that's the main thing I do. But there are big league activation of a part of your nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system that makes blood vessels in all the body constrict. And that hypoxia turns that on. And even after you get out of the hypoxic environment, if you're there for a while and come back to sea level, it stays turned on. Now, what I want to know is, are these 20 and 25-year-old extremely healthy young athletes who are exposing themselves every night to these now at least seems to be pretty severely hypoxic environments, what's the after effect of that? We don't know.
We don't know, say, from the Mexico City experience.
No, that's not enough to tell us.
Didn't have enough to go with.
No, we're only up there for weeks. We know from other experiments done at high altitude that there are substantial after effects. And I just gave you all, I mean, there are effects on the lung, there are effects on blood vessels, there are effects on birth, on reproduction. I like to see studies done with this because I know these athletes are going higher and higher. I don't think I would have had an objection to it if this weird way of doing things stayed at around 7,000 feet. That's pretty mild for a healthy person.
But if they test these athletes that have been sleeping in, you know, hypoxic houses or tents or whatever, mm-hmm. wouldn't they have the same kind of looking blood as somebody who'd been injecting the red blood cells?
Yeah.
So it would be hard to tell who was
It
legally or illegally?
Couldn't tell. I know earlier in 07, they tried to outlaw this. There's this World Anti-Doping Association tried to outlaw the hypoxy tents. It didn't go anywhere. But to me, that's an ethical question too. Is this like doping?
Or is it more like simply locating for a time in the environment in which you're going to compete?
Well, you're not going to compete in that hypoxic environment, though.
Well, if you're going to be back at Mexico City
or that'll never happen again.
They simply are not going to do it. Now, there's another aspect, though. When we think of Mexico City and when we think of Beijing, and maybe this is a red herring, maybe it isn't, but what about the actual atmosphere in those places, which in both instances is notoriously polluted?
Yeah. And that's going to be a major problem. Now, we're off the topic of oxygen lack now because I don't think that'll be a problem there, but the ozone levels. And, you know, in a healthy, non-reactive, I'll explain that in a second, lung, those high ozone levels and pollution levels may not be too bad to an athlete there for sure, only for a short period of time. They're there for the Olympics. But somebody has estimated, and with fairly good data, that over the last half dozen Olympic Games, that somewhere between 10 to 14% of the athletes have reactive airways. In other words, they're like asthmatics. I mean, asthma is a continuum of how the airway reacts. But these people are up a little higher than normal in their reactivity. And many are on medications for asthma to control the airway so they can compete. And there's been big hullabaloo of what medications are legal and which ones aren't. And that's getting ironed out, I think, fairly well now. But if you're an athlete with borderline asthma, then pollution like this is going to be a huge, huge problem. And it's not an insignificant number of these athletes who have this.
Does that get into the politics at all of where Olympics are located?
Oh, I suppose. Well, we had them in Los Angeles, didn't we, twice?
And was it a problem for athletes there?
Well, I think it was to some of them. But they were lucky. As I recall, they didn't get the extreme heat and humidity in the inversion that they were hoping they wouldn't. And I think it, even though it was August, and I think it wasn't bad.
What about athletes? You know how if you have asthma, you have an inhaler and you can inhale things. Or if you're going up Mount Everest, you could have an oxygen tank. What happens to an athlete who just sort of puffs on some oxygen right before competing?
You mean like the pro football players do?
Yeah.
Once they open their mouth and take two breaths, it's gone.
Oh, so it's just a very short – it doesn't really do anything.
Not enough to get you
through. There's the myths around about it's gone.
What about those racehorses? More in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jerry Dempsey. And are we calling it oxygen deprivation? Is that where we're going with this? And its effects on sports, whether it's Olympians or, for that matter, racehorses. What kind of range of sports does this hypoxia affect, this oxygen deprivation? I mean, it's easy to assume that it's going to be runners of some kind. And we talked about mountain climbers too, but how prevalent is it in its effects.
Yeah, running and swimming, I would think, would be the major sports that were affected, and anything that's an endurance event. So competing at high altitude, for example, in sprints is good because that's going to favor the sprinter because the air resistance is down. And while not down a whole lot, it's down enough for these sprinters to make a difference. So anything at 400 meters and above, and probably in swimming at 100 meters and above, I guess I don't know much about swimming, but or things like rowing, sculls, that would make a big difference. So any endurance event, an event that you'd have to sustain, and these Olympic-level athletes, of course, are sustaining work at 85% of their maximum. To contrast that, somebody works on an assembly line at 30% of their maximum all day long, just to give you an idea. Mm-hmm. And we can work in a steady state, all our lungs and hearts and no lactic acid produced or any of that stuff. It's nice, steady state. Heart rate stays nice and constant and everything. But these guys are working at a level that we can't maintain for a steady state. And how a marathoner can do that is just amazing to me. So it's the longer events and those are the athletes, too, that will benefit most from these doping techniques where they add red cells.
Well, what about if it's not an endurance sport? It's something that you just do quickly, like a pole vault or gymnastics feat, but you want to be in the sort of best shape, mm-hmm. best strength as an athlete. Does this sort of conditioning actually help you perform well?
I don't think it would. I don't think it would make any difference. I don't think it would. Strength and flexibility and all of that. You don't need extra red cells for that.
Well, what if we go to the racetrack then, as long as Emily mentioned these horses earlier? Most races are what, only a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
And horses have enormous lungs.
Yeah.
How much difference would this oxygen deprivation mean to them? And are there high altitude racetracks where this is even an issue? How does it come up?
Well, they're a fascinating animal. And I got interested in these in 1980, the mid-80s. We had done some studies here. Usually, people are interested in physiology and the physiology of exertion and exercise. One major question that's highly controversial is what are the major physiologic factors that limit exercise? Okay. What do we have an excess of physiologically and what do we have a deficit of? So that when the crunch time really comes, what organ is it that's failing? And the majority – and because it all has to do how much oxygen are we getting to the working muscle. Okay. So the consensus of opinion throughout the world is – and there's pretty good data on this. It's hard to study in a human, but it's there – is that it's the ability of the heart to put out blood. It's not the ability of the lungs to oxygenate the blood. The lungs, if anything, are thought to be overbuilt.
Really?
Well, I always thought that too until in the early 80s we studied some people around Madison here who were very – you know, this track team here has had wonderful performers. And there were even a couple – there were three or four Olympians here. And we studied a bunch of them. And lo and behold, we found that when they were up – like for example, we had a person running the equivalent of a 4-minute mile on our treadmill. And we had catheters in them. We were taking blood and measuring lots of things. And we studied 18 of these people. I can remember every one of them in great detail in the early 80s. And over half of them showed that the oxygen levels in their blood were falling. It was as if they were at high altitude, but they weren't. They were exercising here at sea level. So the oxygen levels in their blood at rest were completely normal. If I exercised hard on the treadmill, I'm not an elite athlete, my oxygen levels would stay rock constant. My lung would do the job. But the exercise that these guys could do was so high and the oxygen requirements were so high that their lungs were actually failing to oxygenate the blood. So we saw this in a number and we still see – I don't know what number – what the prevalence of it is. We found that it was highly prevalent in women. We did that another 15 years later. A lot of women, again, around Madison studied about 30 of them. It's also in older athletes, you tend to see it too, where the lung does not mature with age. It fails with age. It gets floppier and doesn't exchange gas nearly as well. And so athletes in those categories, the highly trained ones. So the fitter you were, the more likely it was that the lung was not performing its job as a gas exchanger. So this is kind of interesting to academics.
The other parts were just that much more developed.
Yeah, they were doing better. It's not that the heart still wouldn't be a major limiting factor, but now, in addition, the lung was becoming a limiting factor. And we were reporting these data around, and I had a call from a veterinarian in Pullman, Washington, at Washington State, named Warwick Bailey, Australian. And he said, I think we see this in racehorses. I said, no, horse, no, their lungs have, you know, the capacity of the numbers were staggering. And he said, why don't you come out? So we went out. Actually, he didn't have a treadmill like we would have to run the humans. Can you imagine? It's a ton. But they got a treadmill eventually. We did all these studies on a treadmill. We did the first ones with a veterinarian jockey riding and taking blood samples. Oh, that was
I'm sorry, we don't have the video for that.
Same direction. Yeah, well, I don't want to see it. But it hinted in the right direction that, indeed, these oxygen levels weren't being preserved in these horses. They're running the mile in under 2 minutes, right? So there's phenomenal performances in human terms. Okay, so we got a treadmill, and we studied about a dozen of these animals with catheterization. The other nice thing about the human lung, and this is true of even the athletic human lung, is that, although to a lesser extent, that the blood flow through the lung, all the blood has to go through the lung. Okay. And normally we get those vessels nice and wide open so the heart doesn't have to pump against a high pressure. The two big things we found different in these racehorses are, one, that even in a moderately intense exercise, in their terms, they would drop the oxygen levels in their blood. So their lung was not doing the job. Then the other thing was that the resistance to flow, the pressure in their lung was huge. It was like over 100 millimeters of mercury, which is like a systemic pressure. I'm sorry to get the jargon on you there. But it's five times what it should have been. So their right hearts are pumping against all this pressure in their lung, plus they're becoming hypoxemic. So their lungs are terrible. Lungs are really bad. Now they look further. And they found that we didn't find this, other people did, but if you put a little scope, and it's very easy to do that in a horse because they're obligatory nasal breathers and they have huge nostrils. And they don't even know you've done it. You put a scope down their lung. After every little training race, they found red cells in their airways.
So they were actually destructing their lungs.
And when they looked at the lungs of some of these animals, the autopsies, you could see these hemorrhaging and destruction of alveoli, that's the gas sacs in the lung, along certain areas of the lung. Then veterinarians started to do this commonly at race. They never found a horse that didn't have it after exercise. So they're highly, highly susceptible animals, their lungs are.
Well, how much of a run are we talking about here for these horses?
Three-quarters of a mile.
Three-quarters of a mile. These are animals that historically have to run to stay alive.
Well, they do, except the thoroughbred's a little different. The thoroughbred was – I should have said this right at the outset. They're bred in – I can't remember the county in England now – from Arabian stock. And all thoroughbreds come from a dozen animals.
Oh, are we saying –
and all that inbreeding.
Yeah. There's a flaw there that's gotten passed on.
I wonder.
How ironic, too, that it would be the running – mechanism that's flawed.
Well, the running mechanism's great.
But the lung got left behind.
Yeah.
And so, the heart and the vascular system, all the capacities of it are phenomenal. Just phenomenal.
And so does this lead to some, I guess, the equivalent of doping or different training methods with racehorses to try to somehow work with that?
Yeah, well, the dope, okay. now it gets a little more complicated because the horse has no problem with red cells. Horses, dogs, cats, they mobilize red blood cells from their spleen. We don't do that. We do it to a tiny, tiny extent. So, for example, a greyhound animal, and I actually saw these studies being done in Manhattan, Kansas, at a track there by a veterinarian. You take a greyhound, and he has about 35% of his blood is red cells. Ours is about 45%. Okay. He starts walking towards the starting gate. This is a greyhound now. It goes up to 40%.
So this is a conditioned greyhound. He sees the starting gate and he's already mobilizing.
The spleen. Hmm. He's a third of the way through the race. He's now at 50%.
Wow.
He ends the race, he's at 60%. That blood's almost like sludge by the time he finishes.
And it doesn't have a bad consequence then?
Well, I don't know. We don't do them long distances. Mm-hmm. Just very short, and then right back to normal. I mean, this it'll sequester these red cells very quickly, destroy them. It's a whole different bag. So they don't have to sleep in tents. They don't have to do any of this nonsense that we do to get
they can mobilize
more red cells.
That fast.
And the horse is a bit like that too. He'll mobilize, not to the extent that a dog can, but a similar idea. But their problem is not getting the oxygen in to get to those red cells to carry it. And then plus the idea of the vascular pressures being so high in the lung. So with the Belmont Stakes, with
Big Brown,
which was – I remember leaving a ball game early to go home and watch that. It was so fascinating to see a Triple Crown winner. And you could see partway through that race the animal just didn't want to run. And orthopedically, it looked sound. I guess it had a little hoof problem, but they'd fix that, and it looked sound. And the jockey kept saying he just wouldn't respond to the commands. So they claimed that they were going to scope the animal. That means look in the airways for red cells. And I never heard the results of that. I don't know whether they did or not. But I can't believe they didn't find any, because it happens with just about every thoroughbred.
They would have found them in every other horse on that track too. So that really shouldn't have been a factor.
Right. I don't think it would have been. Now, what should they have looked for? I have no idea.
Attitude.
Yeah, you've got a good point, Norman. It may very well have been.
What
yeah.
about animals that are adapted to live at high altitudes?
Oh, there are some beauties. There are some beauties. My friend who climbed Everest, I'm really glad you asked that, said that the – first of all, there's the simple laboratory rat we talked about earlier who knows enough to drop his metabolic requirement.
But that's not much of a life if you have to sort of
get out of it. Not doing much, is it? Okay. My two favorites are these. The one is my friend who climbed Everest. The first thing he saw – when he looked up, he said it was very discouraging, were geese.
Geese.
Okay. 35,000 feet.
Wow, 35,000.
The bar-headed goose, a beautiful bird, actually. And they are actually flying to their mating grounds. Okay? So they're enjoying this whole experience of flying that high. And zoologists have tried to figure out what's so special about a bird, and especially these geese, that they can do this. Well, I haven't figured it all out yet, but there's a couple of things we know. One, when their lungs become hypoxic, they don't constrict, like we were talking about earlier. Other mammals do. It's not just the human that does that. Dogs, cats, rats all do that, but these birds don't. That's terrific. The other thing is that their lungs are nearly perfect gas exchangers. I mean, we lose a little bit of oxygen as we go from the gas phase to the blood phase. And that isn't important at sea level because we got lots of oxygen. But at Everest and above, oh, my God, any little bit's important. So that's another part of it. So those are at least two things that they have. My other favorite is a fish that is a descendant of the simple goldfish. And you knew as a kid, maybe you, Norm, I don't know who, I won't say who's older, but I know as a kid, we never had aquariums where you'd bubble air into them.
Right.
You just get fish.
A fish bowl.
You always chose the goldfish.
Yes.
Because they could survive. They eventually died, but they could survive. And this fish that's a descendant, a close relative of the goldfish, can live in frozen ponds, but is active, doesn't hibernate, forages for food, and swims the entire winter in this frozen pond.
You'll see goldfish that way, yes. In the winter, you know, say in North Carolina, someplace that.
Probably
that, you
they'd
look
be like
under
that.
The ice and you'll see.
Yeah, well, I never
there are species
of carp,
but
it's a carp.
Goldfish
it's,
right. poking around, yes.
And so they've looked at the metabolism of these animals and they produce gobs of lactic acid. Well, the oxygen is zero. It's zero in the water,
but
not a little bit.
Lactic acid a harbinger of muscle fatigue?
Oh, yeah. But they take that lactic acid, they got a special enzyme, they turn it into ethanol and diffuse it all over their gills. So, I mean, think of that fascinating machinery to live in these low oxygen environments. And another good example is the llama. They live very well at high altitudes. Or the human fetus. When we're fetus, we live in a very low oxygen environment. It's equivalent to well above 10,000 feet. Okay. Our lungs aren't breathing, remember. We're dependent totally on the mother's blood supply to get oxygen. So we live in a very, very low oxygen environment, but we have very special hemoglobin. So does the llama. Very special hemoglobin that binds tightly onto the amount of oxygen that's there. And as soon as we're born, within a few weeks, that becomes adult hemoglobin. the characteristics of how the hemoglobin binds to oxygen change. So those are three examples or four of animals that are meant to be hypoxic, but adult humans, not in my opinion.
Well, it's fascinating that it would change from pre-birth to birth.
Isn't it something?
That you would be in some ways tougher. I guess it makes a lot of sense when you look at it, but that you would be tougher as a fetus than when you're after you're
right.
born.
But it's a matter of adapting to what biological machinery you have. You have a lung that's filled with fluid. It's not exchanging gas. You don't want the mother's circulation to be overtaxed. I mean, excuse me, I have no idea how this came about, but I'm just telling you what's logical to me. So you'd want it built this way. I mean, this whole idea of how hemoglobin binds to oxygen is one of the most wonderful mechanisms that we have. And the fact that it can change like that is beautiful because it doesn't require energy, this mechanism. Oh, a little bit of metabolism within the red cell, but it doesn't require our organ systems to get jammed up and start, you know, like we do when we go to high altitudes.
Yeah. I would think there'd be some nice carryovers from the work that labs are doing with athletes and lack of oxygen and those patients that have lung disease. In other words, what's learned from studying athletes maybe has some medical benefit.
Well, we know, for example, well, I hate to say this, but one good carryover is from the doping field. But, I mean, patients with anemia, lots of kinds of cancers and everything, that these erythropoietin analogs are used a lot. Very, very important. Any patient with bone marrow suppression that's not producing red cells, I mean, this is very, very important there. Now, I doubt very much if it started with the athlete and then was transferred to the humans, more the other way around. I think some of the physiology we've learned by studying the healthy person is certainly applied. And I think it's miraculous when you look at a person with lung disease, how well they maintain the oxygen levels in their blood until the disease gets so, so severe. So this mechanism, this hypoxic constriction of the lung to shunt blood, is crucial to them, absolutely crucial. So we thought when this was happening at high altitude, that's no big deal, but it is a big deal in a negative sense, when the whole lung is involved.
Fascinating.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
A breath of fresh air. Jerry Dempsey, thanks for being with us this hour.
It was really fun. Thanks.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.